Welcome to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm your host, William O'Flaherty. Today's interview is with a previous guest, Dr. Don King. He was on the show before talking primarily about a book of Joy Davidman's letters he edited called Out of My Bone. The focus of this program, however, is a new book for 2013 called Plain to the Inward Eye. It contains selected essays gleaned from his 40 years' experience as a reader and writer on Lewis. Welcome back to the show, Don.
Oh, very glad to be back. Thanks for asking me.
Well, as noted, you've been a guest previously, but for those who have yet to maybe listen to that interview, or maybe it's been a while, take a few minutes to tell about your day job.
I teach at a small Christian liberal arts college in the mountains of Western North Carolina, Mondrake College. And I primarily teach courses in British literature, a little bit in the writing area, but primarily courses in Shakespeare, Milton, Victorian lit, Romantic lit. And every other spring, I teach a course on Lewis called The Imagination and Apologetics of C.S. Lewis. Also, as a part of my day job, I guess you could call it, I serve as the editor of the Christian Scholars Review, which is a quarterly scholarly journal. It's interdisciplinary in nature. So we might publish an article on Christian education, an article on history, an article on biology, all in the same issue. And again, this comes out quarterly.
Let's tackle the title of your new book. Again, it's called Plain to the Inward Eye, which again is a collection of essays. I see from the introduction that it comes actually from one of Lewis's poems. Tell us about that poem and why you selected this title.
The title of the poem is Country of the Blind. And Lewis in that poem is attacking, really almost, he's almost looking ahead, attacking the ideas of deconstruction and the notion that language doesn't have meaning and purpose. So I thought that it would be a good way to start the book, because I've always tried to pattern my own literary criticism after Lewis and writers like Lewis. I actually began the book by quoting Dorothy L. Sayers, who I think has a wonderful way of talking about this kind of literary interpretation. So I focused the title of the book on actually the last line of the poem. I'll just read the last four or five lines of the poem. And again, here, Lewis is attacking the idea that language lacks meaning. And he says, if you don't believe this is the case, he ends the poem this way. Go then about among men now famous, attempt speech on the truths that once, opaque, carved in divine forms, irremovable, dread but dear as a mountain, mass stood plain to the inward eye. And so I'm trying to suggest that when you read writers like Lewis, like Dorothy L. Sayers and so forth, they offer us a kind of literary analysis and literary interpretation that assumes that language indeed does have meaning, and it's a very powerful way in which we can communicate. So in the book, I'm trying to offer the same kind of literary criticism and interpretation.
Being nearly a group of all previous writings from a variety of sources, how did you group or organize the collection?
As I look back over my thinking about Lewis, reading Lewis and writing about Lewis, I saw four main areas in my own writing. The first essays I did years ago really dealt with Narnia in the largest sense. So I decided to select a group of essays where I wrote about Narnia for the book. The second area, which is probably the area that I'm most interested in, concerns Lewis's poetry. An area that I think those who like Lewis and perhaps don't know his poetry well need to spend a little more time looking at, because I think Lewis's poetry informs a good deal of his prose. The third area deals with the two women in Lewis's life that I've spent a good deal of my life getting to know better, and that's the poet Ruth Pitter and, of course, the woman he married, Joy Davidman. And then the last section of the book is really sort of a survey of reviews that I've written over the years. Some are movie reviews, and some are book reviews, and some are review essays. And I thought it might be interesting to sort of take a broad swath of those essays, and certain readers would be interested in kind of seeing how, in my case, one literary critic of Lewis or literary scholar has taken a broad view of these different works and films on Lewis.
As you already mentioned, you are especially known for the specializing in the poetry of Lewis. And you already mentioned that this is often neglected. In fact, some may not even be aware of his poems. You gave a brief comment as to why this is important to understand, but if you would comment further about how understanding Lewis's poetry or his background is important, and what in your new book helps the reader to understand this.
Well, my long interest in Lewis's poetry is based on my belief that a wider reading of his poetry will reveal both his giftedness as a poet, and also the poems themselves will offer a broader perspective on the themes that Lewis explores in his prose, both his fiction and his nonfiction. For instance, and I'll just give a few examples, Lewis, before his conversion, wrote a volume of poetry entitled Spirits in Bondage. And he has a poem in there in which he's very angry at God. He blasphemes God in a poem entitled De Profundis. But then we know later on Lewis went through his conversion experience, and he writes about really the first book he publishes after his conversion is Pilgrim's Regress. And so if you look through Lewis's work, you find these interesting connections between his poetry and how the poetry reflects on later works. And I'll give a few more examples. Lewis's second volume was Dimer, and this is a long narrative poem, and I think it sets the stage in some ways for Lewis the imaginative novelist when he writes the Ransom Space trilogy. The self-doubting poet in Lewis's poem, The Apologist Evening Prayer, is also the buoyant, confident Christian apologist of mere Christianity. The world-weary poet who writes Scholar's Melancholy, another poem, is also the perceptive scholar who writes English literature in the 16th century, excluding drama. And I could go on and on, but I won't do that now. But that's really what drives me to want to get people who like Lewis, who like to read Lewis, to also to consider reading his poem almost in conjunction with the prose. In the new book, the Book of Essays, I have several poems on Lewis as a poet. And again, they're earlier works that I did, but they sort of set the stage for, again, challenging readers to take Lewis's poetry seriously, because what I think they will learn about Lewis as a writer in general, and also the poetry does reflect on Lewis's faith journey.
Well, your book, Playing to the Inward Eye, again, is the title. It starts off with an examination between the relationship of the seven deadly sins and each of the Narnia books. Obviously, since this is an essay and not a full book, it's maybe a little bit unfair to compare it to Michael Ward's Planet Narnia, but obviously some maybe think about that. When you wrote that original essay, were you trying to accomplish the same thing that Dr. Ward eventually did with Planet Narnia?
No, not at all. And in fact, as you know, in the book, I actually review Planet Narnia. What I was doing at the time was not trying to argue that the Narnia series are framed around the seven deadly sins, and not even trying to claim that that idea is sort of an organizing principle in the seven books. Instead, I was really just trying to point out that Lewis may have used each one of the books to explore the ramifications of one of the seven deadly sins, but no, definitely not trying to argue that it serves as a sort of organizing way of thinking about what Lewis was up to. I think that many people have written on the Narnia stories. I think Michael's book is probably the best going right now. I think you almost have to start with Michael's book now if you want to write about Narnia in some kind of critical or scholarly way. I've actually enjoyed over the years watching different scholars write about Narnia and bring new insights and new ideas for us to think about. I don't think there's one, you know, sort of standard way of looking at what Lewis was trying to do in the Narnia stories. I think we have a multitude of scholarly lenses now by which we can look at the Narnia stories. But again, Michael's book, Planet Narnia, it really is probably the best thing going now.
Now, you were just mentioning that you have a review of Planet Narnia in your book. You also have quite a few. In fact, the last third of your book is devoted to reviews you've done over the years related to C.S. Lewis by other authors. What do you hope the reader will learn from this section?
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, the main thing I was hoping to accomplish was offering readers sort of a critical perspective from one Lewis scholar over those years of these various books. Also, some of these books are ones that I think Lewis readers would probably enjoy reading, and if they haven't been exposed to the books before, then the review essay that I've done, or the last section of the book where I talk about the reviews that I've done and actually have some of the reviews there, would give readers the opportunity to read a review and decide if they wanted to go on and buy the book or get the book out of the library or access it through ebooks now or whatever. So I sort of was providing that as a kind of service where people who might have heard about, for instance, maybe A.N. Wilson's biography, people have often heard about the biography, but they've never read it. And so I included the review that I did of that book back in 1990, I think it was. So that's the main reason that I wanted to include the reviews. I also reviewed all three volumes of Hooper's Collected Letters of Lewis, which I think is really a magnificent piece of scholarship on the part of Hooper. So I wrote all these three reviews over about a 7 or 8 year period for the journal Christianity and Literature, and I thought it'd be fun. Well, for me, it was fun just to put them all together in one long review essay. But again, I think that I'm attempting to provide a kind of service for readers who have maybe always wanted to read the letters, but just aren't quite sure whether it would be valuable to do that.
And indeed, I appreciate this section very much as well when I was previewing it here, that that was very, very interesting. In fact, since you mentioned about a biography on Lewis, let's go ahead, I was going to save this for later, but there's a brand new biography out. Now, your review of it is not in this book that we're talking about, and that is the new bio on Lewis by Dr. Alistair McGrath. Can you tell us about your thoughts?
Yeah, it actually is going to be in Books and Culture. That's the name of the publication. Yeah, Alistair has done a great job, I think, with his biography. It's really the first biography in a generation. There is the biography that Alan Jacobs did in 2005, The Narnian, The Life and Imagination of C.S. Lewis. But I think Alan's biography, as good as it is it's sort of a biography of Lewis's imagination, not really a biography of Lewis's lived experience. So you really have to go back to George Sayre's biography, Jack, which was reissued and revised in 1994, and already mentioned A.N. Wilson's biography of Lewis in 1990. We really haven't had a general biography since those two biographies in the 90s. So I think what Alistair has done is just a great job of giving us a fresh reading of Lewis's life, and he has the benefit of a good deal of scholarship on Lewis that's come out since the early 90s. I think there are probably four valuable new, I say new with quotation marks around it, new readings of Lewis advanced by Alistair in his biography. Probably the most thoroughly documented one, and maybe the most interesting one, is his argument that Lewis misdated his conversion by probably as much as 9 months. And I won't try to give away Alistair's arguments, but they're well made and well documented. So I think that's going to be a thing that many Lewis readers will be interested in. Secondly, second sort of new reading of Lewis that we get in this biography is McGrath's argument that Lewis and Mrs. Janie Moore, the mother of his friend Patty Moore, who was killed in the trenches in World War I, Alistair argues that almost certainly Lewis and the older woman were lovers. Now, that's not new. Other biographers have discussed the possibility, but I think McGrath offers, he's the first one to offer more than supposition, and he marshals both circumstantial evidence and then very reasonable inferences in support of that contention. The third valuable thing about his biography is the way in which McGrath looks at Lewis's academic career in Oxford from his initial appointment in 1925 till he leaves and goes to Cambridge in 1955. The earlier biographies sort of touch on this part of Lewis's life, but I think McGrath does a better job of exploring some of the, maybe some of the hard times that Lewis faced there during those years. He was always seen as something of an outsider. And McGrath argues that about the time that Lewis decided to go to Cambridge, he, that is Lewis himself, felt like he was something of a spent force at Oxford. And I think readers will really find that interesting. And then the last or the fourth new reading that McGrath provides concerns the nature of Lewis's relationship with Joy Davidman. In short, McGrath explores the view first publicly promoted over 10 years ago by Douglas Gresham, the son of Joy Davidman, that his mother went to England in 1952 with, quote, and this is a quote from Douglas Gresham, with one specific intention to seduce C.S. Lewis. I think many readers of Lewis have always wondered whether Joy had sort of predatory intentions in going to England and so forth. And McGrath explores this to some degree, and he's able to touch on a new cache of Davidman papers that have been discovered. He wasn't able to tap into those papers as much as he would have liked to because his book was going to press when the papers were discovered. But I can talk more about that because I've spent a lot of time looking at these new papers in a few minutes, if you like.
Well, and in fact, that was going to be part of my next question. Last time when we talked with you, you mentioned about a book you're working on related to Joy Davidman. I wondered if you could update us about is that going to be coming out before too long, and how are you approaching it?
Well, I'm supposed to have the manuscript to the Erdmans, my publisher, by August 31st. I hope I make it. I'm trying, but I've got several other projects I'm working on right now. The approach in this book is, it's not a biography. Instead, it's a critical study of Joy as a writer. She was, I think, a very good writer. Particularly, I think she was a very good poet. So she wrote several hundred poems, but only a very small portion of those were actually published. She published two novels. She published the nonfiction book, Smoke on the Mountain. And when she was in the heyday of her time as a member of the Communist Party in the United States of America, she wrote over 90 book reviews, book and movie reviews that were published in The New Masses, which was the semi-official publication of the Communist Party of the United States of America. The new material that I was just referring to a moment ago comes from a discovery that Doug Gresham made about 2.5 years ago when he was asked to go back to the home of a woman that he had lived with after his mother died. This woman, Jean Wakeman, was very ill and knew that she was close to dying. And so she asked Douglas to come back to the house and essentially clean the house out. And as Douglas was doing that, he discovered a manuscript of Lewis. I'm not sure about this, but I think it's a manuscript of The Discarded Image, one of the last books that Lewis wrote. But underneath that, he discovered over 200 poems that his mother had written, several short stories, and a novella. And all this material was new. No one knew that it existed. So I've spent a lot of time looking at that material, and it's going to form a major part of the book. The most interesting thing, I think, for many readers will be to see that Joy wrote an amazing a sequence of 45 sonnets to Lewis, and their love sonnets. And they're really amazing. She's a really great writer as a sonneteer. And it's clear that she's making a powerful appeal in the sonnets to win Lewis's heart. A lot of questions about the sonnets. Did Lewis ever read the sonnets? Is there any evidence that Lewis read the sonnets and so forth? But that's the kind of thing that I think a lot of Lewis scholars and just Lewis readers are going to enjoy taking a look at.
Well, we definitely look forward to your forthcoming book, which I guess will be for sometime in 2014.
Probably. I suppose it's possible it could come out at the end of the year, but I look forward to being in 2014.
Returning to your latest book, your last essay is actually a new one where you review four fairly recent books related to Lewis studies. Tell us what they are and why you believe them to be worth considering.
The first one is Narnia and the Fields of Arbol, The Environmental Vision of C.S. Lewis by Matthew Dickerson and David O'Hara. I found this to be a really fascinating book. It actually exposes an area of Lewis's work where there hasn't been much scholarship done, and that is, more broadly, Lewis and nature. Dickerson and O'Hara look specifically at Lewis as sort of an environmental writer, and I was a little bit afraid that maybe they were going to try to turn their study of Lewis into a polemic of some kind. But I thought they did a really good job, a really thorough job of looking at Lewis's awareness of the environment and of important environmental issues. Of course, not the kind of environmental issues perhaps that people are concerned with today. But we know Lewis was a great lover of nature, and the many walks that he would take through nature are certainly indicative of that. So I found the book very valuable for that reason. The second book, C.S. Lewis on the Final Frontier, Science and the Supernatural in the Space Trilogy by Sanford Swartz, is the first book since David Downing's book, Planets in Peril, which I think was published in the early 90s. It's the first thorough study of the Space Trilogy, or the Ransom Trilogy, depending on how you want to call that. And I think that, again, Sanford Swartz brings a fresh look at the Space Trilogy and offers, I think, some very provocative and some profound reflections on what Lewis was up to in the Space Trilogy. The third book is The Rhetoric of Certitude, C.S. Lewis's Nonfiction Prose by Gary Tandy. Many people have written about Lewis's rhetoric, but I think this is the first fully fleshed out book where we have a writer who looks at Lewis's rhetoric. It is limited to Lewis's nonfiction prose, but nonetheless, I think it's a very valuable book. And for those who are interested in Lewis's argumentative techniques and tactics, I think that Tandy's book would be one they would enjoy. And then the fourth book, The Cambridge Companion to C.S. Lewis, edited by Robert McSwain and Michael Ward, is another welcome addition to a long series of books in the Cambridge Companion 2 series. I thought that they collected a number of really interesting essays by different writers and considered important areas of Lewis's life. The limitation of this particular book is that so many areas are covered that the essayists involved really don't have enough space to develop the ideas that they have. But nonetheless, I use this book now for the undergraduate Lewis course that I teach as a supplemental text, because students can quickly find out some information on some of the areas covered in this particular Cambridge Companion.
And speaking of that, the final book, The Cambridge Companion, I think you note in your book that the nature of that series was limited in space, so the volume is meant to be not too thick,
right?
But because it covered so many subjects, it had to be brief.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, because I heard others have a criticism of it being so short, and they may or may not have been aware of that, or I wasn't until I read it in your book about the overall series, and it and that they kept it fairly short.
I use the Cambridge Companion for whatever it is I'm working on in a number of courses. I use the Cambridge Companion for instance, to Milton. I use that when I teach a Milton course. So it's not heavy scholarship, but I think it's really good for undergraduates because it gives them, again, a quick look at some important areas in Milton, Lewis, or whoever it is that you're looking at.
Well, now we're coming towards the end of our interview, noting that your book, Playing to the Inward Eye, is a collection of essays. And yeah, I was going to set up a question here about your final essay in a second. But before we get to that, I asked you to prepare what your top essays that Lewis wrote, because just like many people aren't aware of Lewis's poetry, many are maybe not as aware, although there are more books out of collections of essays, but they may have not been as familiar. What essays by Lewis are your favorite?
I've got a lot of them, but I'll just mention six here in no particular order. I've always enjoyed Lewis's essay, Religion and Rocketry. In this essay, Lewis speculates on what would it mean to Christianity if, in fact, life, sentient life on another planet was discovered. I think Lewis muses just brilliantly on a number of aspects with regard to that. Another favorite essay is Learning in Wartime, which Lewis wrote, actually delivered as an address or perhaps a sermon in Oxford at the beginning of World War II, asking essentially, you know, should we be studying, should we be spending our time in intellectual pursuits when it looks as if Western civilization is going to fall apart? Really wonderful essay. I also enjoy The Efficacy of Prayer, where Lewis writes about the idea of petitionary prayer and of the idea of if God is sovereign, if God is omnipotent, then why should we even bother to pray? He already knows what we're going to ask. Of course, The Weight of Glory, a very famous essay where Lewis writes about the importance of each human being and the obligation that we all have to be concerned with the people that we live with and work with and so forth. Meditation in a Tool Shed, another famous essay by Lewis when he talks about distinguishing between looking at something and looking along something. And then maybe a more literary essay, Lewis's essay, Christianity and Literature. As a young scholar, I really was drawn to this essay by Lewis and thought that he made a number of really wonderful points. So those would be my top six.
Okay, very interesting. Well, now, we mentioned that your last essay in your new book here is actually a new one. And towards the end of that essay, you answer the question of, will Lewis be as popular 100 years from now? I found your comments interesting and hope we could, you know, close the interview here with you sharing some of those closing thoughts that you have about that.
Well, you know, I think a writer like Lewis, who's so popular now, I mean, it's going to be 50 years, it is 50 years since his death, and his books still continue to sell briskly, I think it would be safe to say. But 100 years from now, in 2113, will Lewis still be as popular? Which of his works might endure? Will literary scholars still be writing about Lewis? Some ways I certainly can't answer those questions, and the next several generation of Lewis scholars will probably attempt to answer that. But I personally doubt that Lewis's influence will completely fade in the next 100 years. I think that probably the Narnia stories maybe the most long-lasting, hard to say, but I think they probably will be the most long-lasting. I suspect that some of Lewis's literary criticism will continue to be important. Yes, it will be challenged, as it already has been, but Lewis wrote The Allegory of Love in 1936. Not everyone agrees with many of his ideas in that book, but you almost have to start with Lewis and begin by disagreeing with him and then going from there in that particular book. But I guess I'll just sort of close by saying, or I affirm that I think he'll probably be remembered by future generations as a composite of someone like John Milton and John Bunyan and Dr. Samuel Johnson. Lofty comparisons, but I think deservedly so.
All right. Well, again, the book by Dr. Don King is called Playing to the Inward Eye, a collection of mostly previously released essays as well as book reviews related to C.S. Lewis and a full range of his writings and such. Thanks, Don, for being with me again.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you, William.